This is Kelly Henderson, and you are listening to the Velvet's Edge podcast. This week, my guest is Kaylee Hammack, who is one of the hottest up-and-coming singers in Nashville. Her voice is so powerful that it literally stopped me in my tracks the first time I heard it. She is just 25 years old, but she feels like she has the wisdom of twice her age. We talked about her road to Nashville, how our broken hearts have actually pushed us to follow our dreams, and what she is looking for in the next part of her crazy singer-songwriter journey. Here's Kaylee. Okay, so what in the world is in the water in Georgia? Because when I was thinking about talking to you, I'm like, oh my God, another country singer from Georgia.
Oh my God, I love that you said that. My dad is a well driller.
Yeah.
And he drilled the city wells for a bunch of the areas around us that Luke Bryan, Philip Phillips, Cole Swindell, Cole Taylor, Travis Denning, all of them came from. So my dad loves to say that it's something in the water.
That he did?
Yeah, he likes to pretend it's something to do with him, but... Yeah, I don't really know, to be honest. I think that there's something about being raised in a place like that that is so picturesque and small and slow as far as the way it moves, that I think what it does is it creates creative people. I think it's a bunch of storytellers just wanting to tell their stories down there.
Gosh, so you're from Ellaville. Where exactly is that?
Yeah, Ellaville, Georgia's on the Alabama line, about an hour from the Alabama line. It's more central west Georgia, but we grew up probably an hour from the Alabama line.
Wow, you're a self-described hippie in a hillbilly town, which I love. I saw somewhere that you said you always wanted to be different. You would just pray to be different, which I thought was so interesting because most kids are like, I just want to be the same as everyone. You know, you just want to fit in. So why did you, what did you feel about that? Or what do you mean you wanted to be different?
I don't know. When I was really young, when I'd watch these movies of people in the perfect little whitewashed house with a whitewashed picket fence, and they seemed so happy, but for some reason as a child, it scared the hell out of me. And I don't know why. It just did. It just didn't seem like that should be the end goal for me. I wanted something different.
Yeah.
And of course I've always wanted love, but I always wanted something that I didn't see around me at the time. And I don't know. Now as an adult, I'm like, oh gosh, I would love the consistency of having a little tiny house with a picket fence. But there was something as a young girl, I just wanted something completely different than what everyone else wanted. And I realized that a lot of my friends, the ones that, I mean, killed themselves trying to look and be like everyone else, they were never happy. It just never seemed to really make them happy when they wore someone else's clothes and wore their style and did what they did to try to fit in. It never truly gave them peace. And when I saw that, I was like, well, I don't want that at all then. If it's not going to make me happy, then why do I have to dress like everyone else?
So did you know that that looked like being a singer for you, or was that kind of something you figured out later on?
No, it was funny. Like when I was young, I felt like I didn't have hardly any friends until I started singing.
And oh, really?
Yeah, I was that weird kid that no one really understood, but I was nice to everyone, so no one really bullied me per se. It was just, I didn't really have a very close set of friends. I just was sort of friends with everyone and kind of stood on the wayside with myself, you know, in high school. And I don't know, when I started singing, it just felt natural to me. I love telling stories, and that was a way that I could tell stories. So I kind of just gravitated to it. But for a while, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I just knew that I wanted to do something that made people smile. I wanted to do something that put good in the world and made people happy and made them happy to see me, you know?
Yeah.
And I realized when I started singing that even though I'm singing these corny covers and stuff, that the kids kind of gravitated to that because it was something that they hadn't really seen as much of. So I don't know. I think music has this connection and this pull on everyone. And that started to become my way of connecting with the kids in my high school that I wasn't really able to connect with at first. And I feel like once I found music, I started finding myself, and it slowly I just realized it was the right path.
So then I've heard you do a couple interviews now at this point because we kind of run in the same circle, but I love the story about you got a scholarship to go to Belmont, right? Was that through singing?
No, it was actually through, I went to athletics and academics. So okay. I played tennis. And I also, I just studied hard. I worked hard, got good on my test, and mostly it was academic scholarship. So I was really excited about it. It was all I'd worked towards my entire life, because my parents had always told me, like, if you want to go to college, you work hard and get that scholarship, because that's how we're paying for it, you know? So I got the scholarship, and my parents were so happy and proud. And the thing was, that whole time I was just falling in love with a boy in my hometown. When I told them that I was leaving, that I got the scholarship, I was going to move to Nashville, and that we can work it out and you can come visit me. And anyways, he just broke down. And when he was like, I just can't see myself going on in this little town without you, I just gave it all up. And
so left the scholarship. This is like basically your biggest dream, to move to Nashville. And
yeah, it was all I wanted. It was all I ever wanted since I was 13. And I begged my parents to drive me to Nashville the first time. That was all I ever wanted, was to get to Nashville. But then I found love. And in my head, I thought that was what I was supposed to go for, you know? Yeah. The end scene in these Disney movies when I was being raised was the guy and the girl kissing. It wasn't her sitting in an apartment by herself in a big city.
With a guitar.
Yeah. So it's just like, I thought that was what I was supposed to reach for. And it wasn't that anyone taught me that. It wasn't anyone else's fault. I am a very heart-driven person. And when I love someone, I love hard and deep and fast. And I just gave it up because I thought that was the right thing to do. And it felt awful. Felt like I was ripping wings out, but I did it.
And then what happened? This is the story that I love.
So I find out a few months later, I can tell he's getting more distant and more distant. And that scholarship is out of reach of getting it back. And anyways, I find out that he's been running around with this nurse on the night shift, which sounds like a damn country song.
But, totally.
Can I cuss on here? I hope I can.
Have at it.
But anyways, so it turns out that he's been running around with some girl on the night shift that he was going to school to be a nurse. And anyways, I'm sick. You know, I literally go home and throw up when I find out. I just can't get over the feeling of it.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of stuck in my town for a while thinking about this boy. I started dating other guys, trying to get over him, you know, and I just was lost. And finally I got to the point that I was like, you know what? I'm done. I have bet everything on love now a few times and it's not working. It's never played out in my favor. But the one thing that has always been there for me and has never betrayed me in any amount or any way was music. That was the one thing that made me happy that never hurt me. And that's when I was like, to hell with it. I threw my clothes in trash bags and I drove to Nashville. And I had this motel worked out and I already paid for 2 weeks. And then I got there and I realized it was in Antioch, which isn't the best little area just as a young 19-year-old girl in a new town. And I realized that I was the only female staying at this place, especially by herself. And I mean, me and my dog just didn't sleep. So finally, I just blew up an air mattress halfway, shoved in the back of my car, and me and my dog slept in the Target parking lot in Brentwood on the south side of Nashville for a few weeks and did what we had to do. But, you know, that was how I moved up here. And I think it took all those moments of hard times to kind of, I guess, cement me into this place. I guess it was kind of to the point I was like, you know what, if I can get through that, then I can get through anything. And I did.
And isn't it so interesting how sometimes if we neglect ourselves or choose something instead of ourselves, then when you get forced to really focus on yourself, it makes you realize what you really do want.
Yeah, very, very true. I tell people that, you know, it took me having the worst broken heart I'd ever had at that time to make the best decision for myself that I ever could have, to finally do what I needed to do all along. It took the worst heartbreak. And I try to reiterate that on stage, because I know that when I look out into a crowd, I know that there's at least 5 to 10 girls out there that in between songs, they're checking their phone for some stupid boy, you know, stupid boy. But I know that there's at least 5 or 10 girls out there that are feeling lonely too. Yeah. And I try to make sure that I talk about that, like show all the bad and the ugly, and then go, but you know what, if it wasn't for that, I would not be up here opening up for Miranda Lambert or Dierks Bentley or whoever it is that I'm on the road with, and I wouldn't be able to connect with that girl that needs a song about heartbreak and moving on and trying to find yourself. So I had to go through all that so that I could make the stuff I make.
Yeah. I mean, I love that, because I think you're right that what we grow up seeing about love is just this fairy tale. It's not real life. And a lot of times you do chase after that and you completely forget about your own dreams and what you want. And
yeah,
I think it's cool to like be, to have the full reminder, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So you come to Nashville, you're living out of your car. What happens next?
Yeah, so I snuck in Honky Tonk Central at 5 p.m. because I knew at 6 they start checking IDs.
Oh.
And so
you're 19 at this point.
Yes, and I have a fake ID that says I'm 23.
Okay, so you're legal.
Yeah, I'm legal. But I'm still terrified to use it in certain places, like Paradise Park, when they have the little stand outside that has all the fake IDs and varnish on it, you know, terrified that I'm going to get it taken, because I know that if I get my ID taken, I have no chance of getting in these bars. And this is where the work is that I'm actually qualified for.
This is on Broadway, downtown Nashville, like where everyone hears about the honky tonks. So you're going to sing. Okay.
Yeah. So I go to one of the bigger ones, Honky Tonk Central first. Yeah. And I go up, I beg the bass player to let me sing. And he tells me it's $40. And I'm not normally snarky, like not this much, but I just was like, okay, never mind. And I went to walk away and he grabbed my arm and he's like, come on. It's only $40. Don't you want
to
sing with the band?
Pay to sing with the band?
Yes. At that time, I didn't understand. But then after working there, I totally understand, because some people come in and they are drunk and partying with their friends. And they have that one friend that can kind of sort of sing Neon Moon. And you just can't invite every inebriated person on stage, or else you'll run everyone out.
Yeah.
So that's why we'll go, hey, $40 to play with the band. And if they're serious, then they can come do it. But I remember at that moment just looking at them being like, no, I get paid to sing. I don't pay to sing, but thanks.
Right.
And I turned around and I ran right into the band manager, and his name was Greg Humphreys. And he was the godfather downtown. He was named the godfather of Broadway. He took care of all of us, and he cared about us because he was one of us. He was a bass player, and I worked for him for 2.5 years. He got me up on stage. He told the bass player to not be an asshole and let me sing, and I loved him from that minute on.
Yeah.
He made me sing 6 or 7 songs that day, and then the next day, he made me show up at the back room of Tootsie's, and I had to sing again, do 6 or 7 more songs, and then I had to run the tip jug. And that was the first time I've ever had to perform on stage, then get off stage. And instead of knowing that I'm getting paid, I have to go ask people to pay me based on how much they enjoyed it. It was the weirdest thing in the entire world. And I was prideful. I realized that at that moment, how prideful I was, because I did not want to ask people for money.
I wouldn't want to do that either.
Oh, it was awkward. Yeah. And finally, I ran it. I got back to the stage. I was worried I didn't do good enough. But Greg Humphrey looked in the bucket. He looked at me. He looked back in the bucket. And he's like, you talk slow and you sing good. People like that. Do you want a job? And I was like, yes, sir. And he's like, all right, show up tonight at 11 p.m. right outside Rippy's. And I leaned up to him and I was like, hey, I'm really 19 and like I can't get in. So, and he was like, you meet me on the corner of Rippy's at 11 o'clock and you walk in with me, and no one will ever ask for your ID again.
Oh,
and I was like,
my gosh,
thank you. So he got me into my first gig so that I could get working. And I was always terrified, you know, that someone was going to be like, wait, she's underage, and kick me out and I'd lose my job. But they let me perform and they let me sing. And I did 3 to 4 hours a night, 3 to 4 or 5 times a week for 2.5 years down there.
That's so much singing.
Yeah, it is.
Like when I think about a show, I mean, the headliner's usually doing what, 1.5 hours at the most?
Yeah.
How did you do that?
God, I think. Like, honestly,
Jesus.
I really, when I look back at how much I was singing and how much I was performing, I don't really know how I did it, to be honest, because now I'll do 1-hour-long show mixed in with meet and greets and interviews and travel, and I'm tired by the end, you know? But back then, I really didn't have a life. I just sang, and then I went home, and me and my dog kind of just sat there. I did a bunch of crafts and stuff because I was so bored.
Yeah.
And so I had a bunch of silent time as well. So I think my voice, it conditioned my voice, and I think it was really great because it got me ready for this part of my life where it's a lot more talking, a lot more travel. So I think that time was given to me to kind of build my endurance and really, really test me. I had to really love music to handle all of that and to get through it. And I had to be quick on my feet. I had to learn how to be quick. And it taught me so much.
I was going to say, that seems like a really good way to learn how to perform and engage with a crowd.
Oh, yeah. It was from 13 to 19, I had performed with by myself or with a band or maybe one accompaniment. Mm-hmm. Company?
Is that a word?
accompaniment? I don't know. Oh, Lord. I haven't drank enough coffee yet. But anyways, it's one of those things. I had my full show together, and we had certain words that the band would cue off and start playing the new song. And, you know, we had a set show. We did it every night, and yeah, we played long hours, but it was a show. And then I moved to Nashville, and you get into Tootsie's, and you get called for a 10 a.m. shift at 10:15 a.m., so you scramble because someone didn't show up for the early morning shift. You scramble, you throw makeup on, you know, fix your hair while you're driving down the street. You're trying to get to work. You get there by 11 and someone goes, someone got drunk last night, stole all the microphones. And so then you have to run across the street and beg the guys at Rippy's or Honky Tonk to bring you microphones. And you can't find the sound guy, so you have to run the sound yourself that day. And it's just the craziest things would happen, you know? And it taught me so much about being on my feet and also learning what people want. Mm-hmm. I used to go up there and do my own set, and I didn't take requests. I just did my own show, and then I got off stage and I went home. And what I had to kind of realize and figure out was what makes people want to stay for your entire 4-hour set and pay every time you walk around with a tip jug. What do you have to play? How much energy do you have to have on stage to keep these people drinking and dancing and laughing and smiling? And how do you make them happy? You know, how do you give them a memorable experience of Nashville and make sure that they're not going to forget you? And that was what Tootsie's and Rippy's and Honky Tonk Central taught me.
Which is so important for your career now, when you, even when you are doing your own stuff, but learning how to engage with the crowd and keep them interested. I think that's huge.
Yeah, it meant a lot to me. At Seven Peaks, after my show, Dirks came up to me and he said, I can tell you're a honky tonker too. He's like, because I had to play the same stuff as you. And he's like, there's something about us that other people don't have. He's like, because we've had to work for it. We had to really connect with those people. And he's like, I can tell that when you get on a big stage that you used to work on a little honky tonk stage.
Yeah.
And that meant the world to me. Just to know that someone else had to work that grind and that they've been so successful with it.
Learning how to command a crowd and just to even work the stage. I think you seem like you've been doing this for years just for that reason.
No, thank you.
So fast forward to when you get a record deal. How does that happen?
Yeah. a lot of prayers.
God again.
God. So I was playing every night, and during the day I was writing with anyone that would write with me. And some of these writes were awful, you know?
Really?
Yeah, because it was just someone I would go out and network, go to Belcourt Taps or, Listening Room or anywhere that there were ride-arounds, and then I would meet people. If I wasn't playing the ride-around, I'd try to meet the people that were and try to get some writes together. And some people you write with, they're great writers. You just may not have chemistry with them.
Right.
So a lot of one-off writes and trying to figure out who I was and figuring out co-writing at that time. I had never really co-written before I moved to Nashville, but I knew that that was the way you networked. That was the way people got to know you. And so I worked really hard at that during the day and then playing every night. And slowly but surely, at ASCAP, Robert Philhart took a liking to me and started just giving me feedback on all my songs. I got into the ASCAP GPS program, which was something that ASCAP did every year where they pick 15 to 16 of their youngest up-and-coming artists or songwriters, And then they push us to publishing houses every week or every month. We'd go meet with a new publishing house, show our music, get some rights, maybe get a deal, who knows. But mostly it was for the rights and the connections. So I did that for a full year. I got a few offers for publishing, which was my main goal. I wanted to show that I was a songwriter before I was an artist. I wanted to show that I worked from the bottom up and that I am well-rounded. So I was like, the first thing I got to do is get a publishing deal. I got to get a cut. You know, how easy is that, right?
Yeah.
So I just meet with all these people. I get a few offers. I get an offer from a manager and they were like, we love your voice. We love your style. We just don't want the songs. We think that we can get you hit songs. And I was like, well, play me what you think hit songs are. And I was laughing out the door. I was like, no, I know that's not good music. I may not be writing hit music, but I know what people like and what people don't. And that doesn't seem like something people like. So I walked out of there feeling even more brokenhearted that someone loved my voice, but not my writing. And after a year of meeting with publishers, getting great rights, but no true great publishing deal offer that felt right in my gut, I went to Robert Philhart at ASCAP and I was like, what am I doing wrong? Just tell me what I need to do. I was like, I'm willing to do anything to do music for the rest of my life, but what am I doing wrong? Why is this not working yet? And he just laughed and he said, well, you know, I don't think you're doing anything wrong. I think you just haven't met the right people. And so he called two different people. He called Stephanie Cox at Cobalt, who is now one of my best friends, one of my nearest, dearest friends in the world. And he called Cindy Foreman, who is now my publisher at Universal Publishing. I met with both of them. I became long-lasting friends with Stephanie. And Cindy and I started working together instantly. She heard the songs, called me the next day. And that was the first time a publishing house had called me the day after a meeting to tell me, you know, they enjoyed it. And I thought that was weird. And slowly, a few weeks later, she put a deal on the table. And I just cried like a little girl. But it was really cool. I got my publishing deal. And pretty much what that did was it gave me the first cornerstone of my career, Cindy Foreman. It gave me a publisher who saw that I was trying to create something different and new, and I was just starting out. And she put me in rooms with great writers that helped me cultivate my craft and grow as a writer and an artist, and also let me grow as a producer. It taught me so much more about the production side of this that I was always terrified of. I never felt comfortable in a studio because I loved singing, but whenever I'd bring my original music in, I felt like I got lost somewhere between the vocal booth and the mix I got back later.
Really?
You know, I'd go in there and sing and I'd try to be myself. And then once the other musicians came in, it didn't sound like me anymore. It sounded like a demo. It sounded like the kind of stuff I got paid $100 to go sing on at a little studio down the street for people. And that wasn't what I wanted. I didn't want what everyone else was doing. You know, I wanted to be different. So the 2.5 years that I wrote at Universal Publishing, just as a staff writer, trying to write for other people, sometimes they would put me in a room and they'd go, hey, write for Carrie Underwood today. And then I wrote Family Tree in one of the rooms that I was supposed to write for Carrie Underwood. And I remember sending it in, and I think it was Cindy that said it. She was like, Carrie Underwood is not going to sing a song about getting high school high. And I was like, yeah, but I would. I would, you know. So it was so funny. Sometimes I was so frustrated when I'd have to go write for someone else, because I would almost write for someone else and then I'd find some edgy line that I was like, ooh, I've never heard this before. I'd throw it in and they'd be like, what? No. Like, I mean, it's cool, but not for this artist. I don't think they're going to say it.
No.
And what really happened was I just wrote, kept my head down. And my publisher, Cindy, was slowly collecting all these songs that she thought sounded like me and were me. And she wasn't pitching them. So I'd ask her like, hey, how'd that song go? And she's like, good. No one, you know, no one took it. And I was like, oh, dang it. I didn't know that she was keeping all these so that I would have something to build my artistry on.
Wow.
She had the foresight that I didn't have at the time. And anyways, yeah, God's blessed me with good people. Thank God. But we got together and one day we sat down and she went, I think you need to make your own record now. I think we got enough. And I was like, yeah, but I don't want to work with these big people. Mm. We named a few big names in town that I love and I respect, and one day it'd be great to work with. But my thing is, I was like, when I go in with someone that much bigger than me, I'm never heard, ever. I've never been heard when I work with some big time producer. And I was like, I want to be a producer. I want to co-produce my stuff. I may not know all the technical terms, but I can make any sound with my voice that I want on the record. So let me go in there and sing and have someone interpret me. Let me learn. I want to try. I want to put my hand to it. And when we started talking about producers and studios, I told her that I wanted someone young like me, because in my career, God's blessed me the most with very young, eager people that have not got to make their mark on the world yet, and they want to make their mark, and I want to make my mark. And when you have people that are like-minded like that, I feel like you just build a really strong inner circle of people. And I wanted someone young that wanted to prove themselves in country music. And Mikey Reeves was another writer at Universal Publishing that the first time we wrote together, we wrote this song about, aren't we all just trying to mean something? Aren't we all just trying to be something to somebody else? And that was kind of the same sentiment that I was trying to get across in this production process. You know, I wanted it to mean something at the end. I wanted it to sound like me.
Yeah.
And Mikey was willing to take that risk. So we went into his little studio. It's this little brick studio with no windows. Very vibey, but we kind of lived in that hole for a while. We do 10, 12 hour days, and it was just me and him with one computer screen, and we would just put weird sounds on it. We worked on Family Tree first, and we added weird stuff to it. We'd beg our friends to come in and play on the record and go, hey, we'll pay you when we have money. Is that all right? And they were like, yeah, that's fine.
You wow. know?
Because we had about a $500 demo budget that we were trying to make it under. And yeah, so we did. We finally finished it. It probably took 50, 60 hours of me and Mikey working on it by ourselves. And slowly but surely, we started working on some other songs. And then My House Burns Down. And then Mary Hilliard meets me, my manager. And she was like, I want to work with you. I think that this music, I've never heard anything like it, and I want to help you put it in the world. And, you know, I just had an electrical fire where I lost everything while I was on a writing trip.
And it's crazy.
My whole life kind of flipped upside down. About the time I thought I was finally a self-sufficient adult with her own garden bed in the yard and, like, you know, like, I'm starting to have savings. What is that?
Right.
And, oh, my gosh. Plot twist. And I told Mary when she said she wanted to work with me that I had nothing left to lose, literally. So why not?
Yeah.
And I think that was exactly where I needed to be to make a jump like that. And after that, Mary put me in the studio with Mikey. She got us really focused, and we kept making this record. We made four or five songs, and then Mary started leaking it around town, just letting a few people hear it, and the label started getting really excited. So we went in, played it for everyone, got the offers we wanted, and used them for leverage to get the record deal we really wanted with Capitol Records.
So you're kind of touching on how important it is to surround yourself with good people in this business, I think. But also, oh, yeah. How important is it as an artist to really know, like, to have your vision of what you want your career to look like?
Oh, I think it's really important. I think that God blessing me with people that could have the foresight of what an artist's life will be like before I even had the capacity to fathom it, you know? I think that was the biggest blessing. Mary and Cindy both are, I mean, they're experts in their field. They've done it for so long and so successfully that God putting them in my life was a blessing. I honestly sometimes don't feel like I know what I'm doing, but I just keep doing it. I think that's the
figure it out
the main goal of life.
We're
is
all doing
even
that.
If you don't know what you're doing, just keep doing it.
Yeah.
Until it does make sense to you. Because every now and then I'll have a moment of clarity where I'll be like, whoa, all this work so I could get here, and this is why this happened, and
right.
You know, blah, blah, blah. But 2 weeks from now, I can tell you I have no clue what I'm doing.
Yeah. So is that how you felt when you, because with most of your songs now, you're in the production process, like you said, which that's rare for an artist to be fully that in the process. But do you feel like you're figuring that out and learning? And
oh yeah, I've learned so much about myself by making this record.
Yeah.
I've learned what really is important to me. I've learned what isn't important to me. And also sonically what my identity is, it's still fluid. It's still changing. I think everyone's sonic identity is constantly improving and changing. But I started to kind of figure out what sounds like me and what sounds make me happy, and kind of figuring out what my connection with the world was. What am I supposed to bring to this world? You know,
what is that? What do you think?
You know, I ask myself that every day, and I feel like another answer comes up and a few more questions.
Yeah. But
it's one of those things that I think I was given this voice, and I was given this yearning to do something in this world, to try and be who I needed when I was younger. All I wanted when I was younger was a role model that looked like me, that wasn't the, you know, slim blonde hair, blue eyed beauty that I knew I couldn't be. You know, I was the freckled kind of overweight kid that was, you know, a little talented in a few ways, but never the picture perfect, you know, and I never connected with those people that were perfect. I want to be the role model that is human, and I make mistakes and I mess up and I might cuss, but I still go to church. And, you know, I want to show kids that you can still be a human being and be a star. That is what I'm trying to do. I want to be a real human being that can stand in the limelight and still show all of her scars and stretch marks and stories, and show them that it's okay to be human. You can still go after your dreams if you don't feel like you look or you don't act or you don't think like the perfect person. There is no sense of perfection.
God, we need that.
Yeah.
Especially young girls.
I think that there's so many artists that are bringing that to the table. Yeah. Lizzo is my huge example for that, because what she has done, it's amazing. She has so much of a background in music that some people don't know from, I mean, she used to work with Prince as a backup vocalist.
I didn't know that.
I believe that was how she started. I need to go back and double check. But she has this background in music that she's so immaculately talented, but I feel like she was put on a shelf because of the way she looked, which I think she's drop dead.
She is.
But the thing is, does she fit the perfect cookie cutter shape that pop music has normally lended us, you know?
Right.
No. And I think that is exactly what makes her as big of a star as she is, because she is so very different that you cannot put her in a box.
No.
And I think that is the most amazing thing about Lizzo, is that she's breaking the barriers as to what a pop star can say, what they can look like, and what they can do on stage, and how they can bring people together.
Yeah.
She put on a show at the Ryman, and
Did you go?
I have never seen more people crunk at the Ryman. Like, it was the weirdest.
So jealous.
It was the weirdest but coolest thing ever. Like, I've never been to a Ryman show where people are just like dancing, like high-fiving strangers, like just getting down with their bad selves.
Yeah.
It was amazing. And I love that she takes time on stage to talk about self-love and, you know, just screw the people that hurt you. You focus on you. And I think a lot of young girls need to realize that.
I love that message is out there for all the young generations coming up. Do you think, have you felt, you know, there's this huge wave of like females in country music trying to make a comeback almost because they've been kind of cut out. What have your experiences been with that?
Yeah, I can't tell you how many writer rounds I've done lately that are all female that they call bra country instead of bro country.
I love
which
that.
Which I actually really love. I'm going to start calling just female country bra country.
Bra country.
But it's really cool. I think that every now and then I feel like women, we get, at least for me personally, and I know that Maren Morris emphasized this at the end of her Girl video, that the difference is men are never asked what the difference is to be a man in country music, but we are always asked that. And I'm sure you're asked the same thing in your profession.
Yeah.
So honestly, I think it's really cool. I think that all of this that has somehow beat down women in country music and has kept them from shining has angered them enough that now we can make the rise we need to make. I think that we're all going to rise as a wave all together. And I'm just waiting for 90s country to come back where it's all these women telling their stories. It's, I love the men, and I'm not trying to be sexist by putting women above men, but there is something about a woman's way of telling a story that I think would connect with our audience so much more than a man can if given the chance and the opportunity to be heard, because they say that about 80% of our fan base is women. So why are there not more women telling their stories or getting to tell their stories? I think that all of us women binding together and rising together is the way we're going to do it.
I love what I've heard Maren say one time before. The most interesting thing about me is not that I'm a woman.
Exactly. You know? I love that.
It's so good. Well, you're such an old soul. I mean, you're what, 25 now?
Yeah.
This is like a fun fact about Kaylee Hammett, because I feel like when I'm talking to you, you're like 40.
Oh, yeah.
your life experience seems like you've just, I don't know, such an old soul.
My dad said I was born 35.
Really?
Yeah.
That sounds about right to me. Okay. I want to do some fun facts about Kaylee Hammock, which the age thing was the first one, but I spent the day yesterday with Mary Hilliard, who is your manager.
Oh my God, this is bad. What did she tell you?
And also, I mean, yeah, she's one of my really great friends. And so I was like, what do I need to know about Kaylee that she hasn't been asked yet in an interview, because like I said, I've heard a bunch of your interviews. So I was like, I need to do something just a little different. So she goes, well, ask her about her ribs, because you just got a massage.
Oh my God.
Tell this story. This is very interesting to me.
Yeah, very odd. So yeah. I was on the road with Dierks Bentley, and I had had some issues with my voice at one point where I was just getting so tight and so sore very quickly. And I went to my vocal doctor, and he said, your vocal cords are fine, but you're holding way too much tension in your neck. That's what's causing all the pressure and stuff.
Oh.
So he was like, you have to get a massage every day before you sing. And I was like, God. Doctor's orders? Like, oh my God.
Can I get a note for that?
I know, seriously. So I went to Amanda, who was on the road with Dierks and was giving everyone massages. And anyway, she was massaging my neck and my shoulders. And then she said, well, do you want me to massage your diaphragm? Which I've never had someone massage my diaphragm, but she had told me, I have no clue how this works, but she said that sometimes when singers sing a lot, their diaphragm gets stuck to their ribs and she can remove it. She can get it off of my ribs. So she's like reaching around like inside my rib cage, like kind of pulling them wider and smaller. And anyway, she's feeling around on my rib cage, and I'm kind of just laying there like wondering what this is going to do to my diaphragm. And she said that I'm missing a bone at the bottom of my sternum. She was like, that's funny, you don't have it. And I was like, I don't have what? What am I missing, you know? And she said, you don't have, there's this little tiny, it's almost like a little triangle at the bottom of your sternum. And she said, you don't have that. And she goes, only about 3% of the population don't have it. She was like, but she goes, that little piece, what it does is it reinforces your ribs. She said, so it actually is probably better for you because you can increase your lung capacity and breathe in and out wider normally. Your rib cage can actually spread wider than an average person's.
So you're missing bones, and it probably makes you a better singer.
I'm guessing.
Wow.
I mean, that I was like, whoa, Amanda.
Yeah.
And then I went back to the dressing room, and I like pulled my shirt, and I was like, do my ribs look funny? And I was like showing the whole band, and they're like, no. But yeah,
can't see it externally.
It's weird. I never knew
That's
that.
Crazy.
But then I went home, and I was like,
yeah,
trying to see like how big I could get my ribs to be.
Oh my God. That's so interesting. Okay. Also, you are the biggest makeup lover, which I love on your Instagram.
Yeah.
You've started doing little kind of tutorial type
things.
I love it. This is amazing. Okay. So talk me through, what are some of your favorite products? Because you're really good at makeup.
Ooh. So as far as makeup, one person I love, Charlotte Tilbury.
Yeah.
Oh my
gosh. Good.
She has this magic cream that it's a cream, a moisturizer, and she actually became famous through that. I believe her entire career kind of was based off this magic cream that she made, and people just fell in love with it. And then she became a makeup artist with her own line afterwards.
Right.
And anyways, I love this magic cream. My skin's very dry, so I love it. I also just got into Gua Sha.
Oh, I don't know about this.
So it's, I truly believe in Eastern medicine and everything to do with Chinese culture and Korean culture. I feel like they have a a step up, I think, in their skincare and their beauty over us. So I got into it. It's called Gua Sha. And it's this little jade stone. It can be made out of buffalo horn, rose quartz, but I have a jade one.
Cool.
And
okay.
What it does, sha is scraping, and it translates to scraping in Chinese. And it's really good for your immune system. I use it on my face and my neck and my chin.
Yeah.
But it's pretty much this piece of stone that you pull your skin with. You do like a scraping motion with.
So is it like jade rolling kind
of? It is like jade rolling.
Okay.
Jade rolling is more of for the cooling of it.
Yeah.
And for depuffing.
Yeah.
This is to work your lymphatic system to make it all release in your face and your neck. And also they call it their needleless Botox. Supposedly it helps to tighten your skin by doing this every,
we all want that.
You know, every few days for about 10 minutes. It just feels good. I can feel that my lymph nodes are draining and such when I use it.
Yeah.
Which helps with puffiness in my face. But dang. I love that. Let me think. I love Anastasia. I mean,
yeah,
it just
the brows.
That brow gel is the best brow gel ever.
A good brow is very pertinent to a full good, like a real makeup look, I think.
Yep. And I did find this thing, though, it's really good on the go unless you're in an airplane.
Okay.
It will explode in your face.
Oh, that's not good.
I've done it so many times. But Urban Decay made this thing called a brow blade. And
okay.
It's like a felt tip liner that you'd use for liquid eyeliner, but it's for your eyebrows. And then on the other side, they actually have the stick. So
ooh,
it's really nice if you don't want to carry a bunch of brow stuff with you, but you want that look of like having the brow blading as far as putting an individual follicle look in.
Like the feathering.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just making that, making it look more natural than drawn on.
Yeah. So you guys can also go follow Kaylee on, what's your Instagram handle?
Kaylee Hammock.
At Kaylee Hammock. She's starting to post a lot more about her different makeup looks. I feel like this is a true expression of how you are feeling or like what the vibe is of the night. You totally build your look around that.
Yeah. I feel like my face is my first... It's the first thing people look at. So for me, it's like the doormat of my personality. I'm like, I got to show you that I'm weird. Got to show you how extra I am right now.
I loved your look for the Opry debut, which is a huge deal.
You.
Congrats, by the way.
Thank you.
So how fun was that? Was it just...
Oh, man. It felt like I was getting married. It was
really?
A little stressful backstage. We were filming so much.
Yeah.
And I had also just gotten the iHeart on the Verge, and there were about 200 radio stations needing liners specifically for them that day.
Yeah.
So in between recording video backstage with my family for the Opry debut video, and then... also trying to do sound check for my true debut that night and then running to the glitz and glam room to get the liners done. It was a very stressful day, but I just played again at the Opry and it's so much more calmer, I guess, when you're after you've done your debut and you're finally a little bit more comfortable with it. I'm enjoying it more every time I go because it's just feeling more natural.
Yeah.
But the first time I got up there, I cried like a baby.
It's iconic.
It's all I've ever wanted.
Yeah.
Which kind of scared me too. I was like, oh Lord, should I have dreamed for more?
Right.
You know, like,
is it?
To me, that's bigger than any award that someone can give me is getting allowed and embraced on that stage. That's the big one to me.
That was amazing. Well, so Family Tree is out now, which you co-wrote, co-produced, and also I saw that it was the highest, what was it, the highest added single by a female in 3 years.
Yeah.
I mean, hello.
Yeah, it's always exciting when you see a stat like that.
Yeah.
It shows that you're on the right path.
Yeah. So you guys can go listen to Family Tree, but when you were telling me before, when... does new music come out or more music?
So what we're working towards, what I am like hoping works, we're planning on hopefully having a full album in February. I'm working through masters right now, about to send the masters into the label.
Exciting.
And that means we're right at the end. You know, after this, it's what is the album cover?
Yeah.
And what is the back of the CD going to look like? Which is like the coolest part. I've never got to really work on that part of the music.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited to see where this goes, but planning on February.
Well, if you guys need to go listen to Family Tree and also be aware of the new music coming out, Kaylee is a powerhouse vocalist. Also lyrically, I was listening to so many of the songs this morning as I was getting ready. And that's when I was saying to you, you're about the old soul. I'm like, how does she know how that feels? It's amazing. Like you're describing stuff that I've been through with heartbreak or just finding myself and all of these things that took me a lot longer than you. So,
hey, no, I'm just glad you connected.
Oh, absolutely.
That's what I love.
A couple of them brought me to tears. So it was very, very exciting. I'm not going to have you sing a normal song, but I do need to hear some Disney voices because I also heard.
Oh, my God.
That this is like one of your tricks.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I love that you were hanging out with Mary. She would say this.
Of course.
So her little girl, Scarlett, loves Mickey Mouse. And I'm a little hoarse. So let me try it. But it's like.
Hi guys, welcome to Walt Disney World. Gee willikers.
I can't do it hardly today. I'm getting over a cold, but I used to do that, and then I do like Ariel and stuff. Like, look at this stuff, isn't it neat?
Oh my God, you just cured
my
Siri.
My Siri just turned on. She just said, I'm your assistant and your friend too.
Oh, thanks, Siri.
Thanks, Siri. You're not in this interview. Maybe she's telling me to shut up.
Oh, my God. Mary was like, you have to ask her. She's oddly good at Disney voices.
Yes. I'll come back and show you what I'm not so hoarse.
All right. Well, you guys go check Kaylee out on Instagram at Kaylee Hammack. Where else can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. We're going to be posting a bunch more makeup videos.
So. Fun. And website is KayleeHammack.com. Make sure to check it out for updates on when new music's coming out. Yes. You guys are going to love it. Thanks for being here. This is fun.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Bye.
This is Kelly Henderson, and you've been listening to the Velvet's Edge podcast. I truly believe that every one of us has a little velvet and a little edge. So it's so important to remember that to be strong, you must be soft too. Thank you so much for sharing in those stories with me. You can follow Velvet's Edge on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, as well as velvetsedge.com. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join me every Wednesday for more conversations on lifestyle, beauty, and relationships. Thanks for listening.